fare thee well, my one and only. I am traveling overseas for my country doesn't want me, and my faith is on its knees. I will follow every highway through the streetlights and the chrome, and find a city where someone needs me, in a place to call my own.
On Sunday night, I was in Dublin, was the last day of the year, walking through a concrete wasteland. All that ancient hope and fear, there was nothing left to reach for, to pull myself out of the fray. I got my ticket now, and I am leaving, so don't worry, walk away.
Fearing and White are back on tour in Ontario and Alberta. The collaboration between Stephen Fearing and Andy White released their second album, Tea and Confidences, earlier this year. We caught up with Andy White prior to their barnstorming appearance at this year's Hillside Festival, and it only seemed fair that we check in with the other half of this pair of wandering minstrels. We reached Stephen Fearing at home in Nova Scotia. So it's great to talk to you today, Stephen.
Yeah, you too, Jan. It's been a while. I mean, I saw you at Hillside there briefly as the rain was starting to come down.
Well, I had a chance to talk to Andy before your appearance as Fearing and White at the Hillside Festival, and I thought it would only be fair if I did get an interview with you before these Ontario dates. I know there's going to be some Fearing and White dates in Ontario, and then you're also heading out to Alberta as well. You're a very busy man because you've obviously got your solo career as Stephen Fearing. You're also a huge part of Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. And then you have this great collaboration with Andy White. Now, I wonder how easy it is for you to actually keep all of these different things separate and work out what you're doing at different times.
It's a real challenge. And, you know, just we could talk about that for a long time. And I often do with my agent. There's so many different aspects to trying to keep them separate and keep them all going. With Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, it has its own momentum in some ways. It's more about trying to keep the other things going around that. My solo career as well, although the difference between Blackie and the Rodeo Kings and what I do solo is, you know, obviously musically there's a big difference, sonically there's a big difference, but in terms of the audience, there's a pretty big difference as well. With Fearing and White, even though Andy and I have been playing and writing together for a long time, we haven't actually really dedicated ourselves to performing as Fearing and White as much as Blackie has or as much as I have. And so the duo tends to lean a little bit more on my audience in Canada and to some degree some of Blackie's audience. And, you know, people get confused pretty easy. You know, when I was younger and when I was more involved in kind of mainstream stuff through True North Records, my manager, Bernie Finkelstein, you know, who's been in the business since the 60s, you know, he would always say to me, Stephen, you've got to keep it simple. You can't diversify too much because people won't know. They get confused, you know. It happens still. People come to see a Fearing and White show and they think that they're coming to see me solo. You know, and it's maddening sometimes, even though you try and make it very clear, saying Fearing and White, not Stephen Fearing and Andy White, but as a separate entity. As I say, I could talk about it a long time. There's a lot of different issues that come up. What song goes to which band? Do I keep this song that I've written for myself? Do I bring this idea to Andy? You know, on and on and on. And sonically, how do you make the different projects distinctly different such that you could go through a market as a solo artist and then 6 months later come back through as Fearing and White and people would understand that it was going to be a very different show.
I look at the people that you're involved with, being involved with Tom Wilson and Colin Linden in Blackie, and then Andy. I mean, you're all very driven individuals. If I look at just you and Andy, you're both incredibly hardworking. You're always on the go somewhere. And that probably does make it easier at the end of the day to work out what you're up to, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's never a matter of, you know, me trying to sort of rouse Andy from the couch to, you know, we've got to do this, we got to tour. It's much more about how do we make this fit in with our both of our crazy busy lives. And given the fact that he lives in Australia, you know, automatically our tour costs start with this big airfare, you know, his and then mine. And then there's two of us. And now three, we're currently touring as a trio. So the costs start to escalate. And it's just so much more logistically complicated than me. Me is easy. It's in some ways, touring solo is just, it's kind of like what I do to relax. It's just so easy. I put together some shows, I get in a car or fly and then rent a car and that's it. It's just me. But with Andy and with Fearing and White and with the Rodeo Kings, it's a lot of logistics. Yeah. So on the one hand, yeah, you're right. Having very driven people makes things a lot easier because you're not trying to motivate people. But is what do you do with all that energy? That's how it gets difficult because there's a momentum to these things that you have to keep rolling. And somehow you have to hold all the balls. And I'm mixing my metaphors like crazy, but it is like juggling. You've got to keep the balls in the air. If they drop on the ground, there's a danger that you might lose one of them for a long time or get it covered in dust or, the metaphor falls apart. I think you understand what I mean.
That's interesting when it comes to actually recording together because you end up incredibly focused. I know when I talked to Andy, I think he said that You did at least a period of writing together when you were on Salt Spring Island. Is that right? Was that the first album or the second one? I get confused.
That was the second record. The first one we had, because we weren't trying to be Fearing in White. We were strictly writing for the fun of it. You know, it was a very interesting way to get together with somebody. So many times when I'm writing now, it's because I'm about to make a record of my own, or Blackie's about to make a record, or, you know, there's some sort of deadline. And so you get together to write specifically around that. I don't know if that, you know, they say making records is a bit like making sausages, which is if you enjoy eating them, it's best not watching them be made. And I don't know if that bursts bubbles for people where they think that artists just sort of, you know, we lie around by a lake and sort of create songs and then go, oh, I've got a 200 songs. I'd better make a record. You know, it's not like that. It really is. I have to make a record in the next 6 months so that I will have something to go and knock on Jan Hall's door and say, hey, I got my record. Can you talk to me? And then I can go and play my shows. That's not in any way to sort of make out that the process is cold or unpassionate or something that I don't feel. A career is something that you have to feed and tend like a garden. You know, you really have to put a constant amount of work into it. And so adding two careers and three careers, which is essentially what you're doing with these different bands. They all have their own life. They all have their own peculiarities, and you have to treat them differently and look after them. So as far as writing is concerned, Andy and I, our first sort of batch of songs, it was something that we wrote very slowly over a period of 10 years. When he'd come over from Australia, we were getting together as friends. We would play a couple of shows for the fun of it. And we would write a couple of songs, and it was really as a sort of, this is what we do when we get together. We don't play bridge. We don't go to the pub and drink. I mean, there was a little bit of that, but it was always around the work. That was what we liked to do. And at some point we started thinking, what are we going to do with this, with these songs? I brought a bunch of them to Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. And then I think we both felt kind of like proprietary about the songs and we should record them ourselves. And so that was the impetus behind the first record. Once we put out the first record, we were now officially a thing. And we have to, then you have to start feeding it. And we didn't have the luxury of waiting another 10 years. We basically had a period of about a year. And given that he lives in Australia, that was actually a tiny amount of time. So he came over to play a festival with me in the Vancouver Folk Fest. One weekend, and the following weekend, we had another festival in Duncan. We had 5 days off, which is, you know, often the case in the summer. And so we hove off to a little cottage on Salt Spring Island and wrote our brains out for 4 days. I mean, it was, I've never really done it like that with another person. I've written like that on my own. But it was very intense and exhausting and really exciting. Because we went in with, I think we went in with maybe three, four that were pretty much there. And we came out with an album. We wrote like 7 or 8 songs or more in a 4 day period, which is really astounding. And we both kept looking at each other and kind of second guessing them and wondering if they were any good, because I don't know why. I mean, you sort of think, well, this mustn't be good if it's taken us this short period of time. But we worked very closely during that time. We worked very quickly and we worked smart. We were constantly editing each other, constantly not criticizing in a negative way, but always pointing out this here, this is weak, we can change that, and then doing it right then and there. And so after a couple of months after that initial writing period, we got on the phone with each other and said, right, well, I've been listening to these rough demos that we've done on our iPhone, you know, at this little cottage. And I like these songs. There's a couple of things that I'd want to change, but very, very few. And so we booked a recording session, and that was our album.
And that was with Scott Merritt in Guelph, right?
Yeah.
How many times have you worked with Scott over the years? from a production point of view?
Well, we did all our demoing there. I think the first time I ran into Scott, the very first time I met him was with Willie P. Bennett. Willie's album Heartstrings. He was recording different songs with different people all over Ontario. I was in Guelph, so he suggested we go to Scott's studio, and we worked on a song called Brave Wings. That was when I met Scott. I knew of him before that for sure, but I'd never been in his studio. And I was really impressed with it and him and just the whole vibe of the place. It's very calm at Scott's studio. That's his whole thing. Calm, calm. It's really great. It makes you slow down, and it can be infuriating sometimes because you want to move fast sometimes. But I sort of suddenly realized I live in this town, and there is this great resource right literally around the corner from where I live. So I went back to him for, I've worked on Yellow Jacket. I did half of the record was live and half was in the studio, but it was like one takes, just voice and guitar. I recorded a Susie Vinnick record there. Andy and I have done both our records there. And I've done a little bit of work on the album South that Blackie and the Rodeo Kings just put out. That was recorded in about 2-3 sessions. And one of those sessions I was on tour for. And Tom and Colin basically contacted me and said, we've recorded these songs. We're sending them to you. You need to put on vocals and guitar parts. And so I got these songs as wave files, went to Scott's, put on the headphones, and just threw in my oar. So it's I've worked with him a lot.
It's interesting you talk about it being so calm, because one of the things I love about the way that Fearing and White play together is that the albums always strike me as being very up. Probably in some ways it sounds crazy to say this, but actually you don't want to flip it over in the middle, because it's actually better just to go all the way through, without having to take a break to turn it over. Is that part of the what you enjoy playing with each other? This trading off, we'll talk about the songs a little bit more in a few moments, sure. But this trading off each other?
Oh, yeah, very much. It's really a unique thing to be for me. I mean, I'm in a band with three, and that's a very interesting number. And our rhythm section, we're a five piece. But as far as the creative, the three principles of the band, with Andy, it's him and me, and it's very much a conversation back and forth from the writing to the performing. We both have our sort of strengths, and we both play guitar, but he plays some bass, I play some electric, so there's a natural interface for both of us. We both have a lot in common too, in our past, living in Ireland, living on either side of the border, north and south, growing up in Irish culture. When I come across people who are about my age who grew up in Ireland, I feel an affinity for them because I know it's a small country. I have a pretty good sense of what their background is, and we can share all sorts of cultural references from, adverts for creamed rice, Ambrosia creamed rice, things like that. Just, it's almost like growing up in Newfoundland. There's that sense of place and culture that's very, very strong. And obviously Ireland is much, much older than Newfoundland and much more diverse. But even so, there was a sense of it being an island, and we all shared certain things. So even though Andy lived in Belfast, which was a world away from where I lived in Dublin, even so, we had a lot of touchstones that are in common, and that plays a big part in what we do.
So we're going to talk about the album in a few moments, but I thought it would be a good time to take a break and get you to pick a track from the album to play. The album is Tea and Confidences. I think it's an incredibly strong album, and I love the way you talk about the process of coming up with the songs and putting things together, because when we look at it from our point of view as the listener, it actually gives me a lot more confidence. I feel better with somebody who says, well, yeah, we got together and we worked really hard at pulling the songs together for this. Obviously, if you know a bit of their background, then somebody who says, oh, well, it took me about 2 to 3 years to find enough songs to stick on an album. So I love the album. What would you like us to play?
The first track on the record is Tomorrow Takes a Long Time, which, you know, the first line, "Let's meet at 8 for Tea and Confidences." We had to decide whether the album was going to be called Tea and Confidences or the track. And this is the kind of micro level that Andy and I will get embroiled in. You know, I'll say, "Well, we should have the same title as the first song for the album." And he'll say, "No, I think we should not." And he'll have all these reasons, and we'll debate it back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then we'll finally come to consensus. The song itself came out of a guitar riff. You know, it starts with a guitar riff, which a lot of them do. Sometimes it starts with a line or a phrase or an experience, but a lot of times they start with a guitar riff. And then you just start trying to pull this song out. It's like I always struggle to try and find a good metaphor for it, but it's really like imagining yourself as a sculptor, and in front of you is a chunk of wood. And you either go in and decide that you're going to carve a dolphin or a mask out of it because that's what you got in your head, or you just start chipping away with a chisel and a hammer, and you start to let whatever is in the wood come out, which sounds very, I think it sounds very weird to somebody who is actually not involved in that sort of process. But that is actually how a lot of artists work. It's not going in with a predetermined idea. It's letting the idea come out of whatever medium you work at. And it's scary, because you have to have a great deal of confidence that you're going to get something in for all your hard work, but also that it's going to be good. And with Andy and I, we've been doing it long enough now that we're both really confident that we can just sit down with two guitars and stare at each other and start noodling and be very unselfconscious about it. And out comes a song like Tomorrow Takes a Long Time.
You're listening to Folk Roots Radio. I'm Jan Hall. Our guest today is Stephen Fearing, and we're going to take a break with Tomorrow Takes a Long Time from Fearing and White's wonderful new album, Tea and Confidences.
It's late for tea and confidences.
takes a long time.
That was Fearing and White with Tomorrow Takes a Long Time from Tea and Confidences. My guest today is Stephen Fearing. He's at home in Halifax, getting ready to head out on the road because Fearing and White, which is his collaboration with Andy White, will be heading out across Ontario and Alberta again this September. And I've got to ask you as we go back to the conversation, Stephen, Alberta and Ontario seem to be popular places for Fearing and White. Is that something intentional? Some special feelings about those two areas of Canada?
Well, yeah, there's a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, the density of population is a big part of it. The fact that I lived in Ontario when I met Andy, I lived in Guelph for 16 years. So we became friends. We decided that we wanted to just hang out together. He was naturally coming through Ontario because there's a great density of population. There's a great history of this kind of music, roots music, folk music, whatever you want to call it, you know, lots of clubs and places. So he was naturally coming through anyway. And it seemed obvious that we should try and do something together based out of my hometown of Guelph. Alberta, Calgary has the greatest collection of folk clubs, I think, in the world in one city. There's 11, 12, and they're not just little folk clubs. They're clubs that meet every month and have audiences of 500 people come out regularly to those clubs. Some of them are a little different formats from each other, but they're all basically the same thing. There's a guest artist that's playing. You may have an opening act or guest spots during the night. There may be a house band, but they bring in a featured performer. And people are members of the club and they come. So that's Calgary. Edmonton has a few of the similar kind of thing, but they both have very, very strong festivals that encompass everything from Hey Ocean and the most sort of current bands on the roots music scene, Deep Dark Woods, Harp Axon, you know, all that sort of current stuff. And then all the way back to Valdi and Roy Forbes and Sherry Ulrich and, you know, this sort of earlier wave of Canadian roots folk music. Some of them have very strong connections to Stan Rogers. You know, you'll hear the Marianne Ellen Carter sung as the last song on a Sunday night on the main stage. So it's a pretty wide swath of music. And, you know, Edmonton pretty much sells out every year. You know, they've had Van Morrison, they've had Katie Lang, they've had very large international artists on their stages, and they sell out. So you've got, I don't know how many thousand people going to each of those festivals. There are a lot of people from out of town, but what it does, what it means is that you have this sort of annual pilgrimage to this kind of music. And then throughout the year, all the small clubs and all the small concert venues are promoting this kind of music as well. Plus they have CKUA radio, which is a really special and unique thing to Alberta. It's a province-wide radio network that is listener-funded. So it's kind of like the PBS model of radio. They have fund drives and all this. They play a lot of this kind of music. And it's you know, CKUA is going through changes just like everything else, but they're still managing to maintain their identity. And you can hear CKUA just about anywhere in Alberta, from, you know, little tiny towns in the mountains to the Lethbridge and Medicine Hat. So it means that there's this connecting thing. And if you can get your record played on CKUA, it's played province-wide outside of any connection you would have with CBC. So that's a huge thing for the likes of me. It means, you know, if I can chart at number one on CKUA with Fearing and White, which we have been able to do, then, you know, you're immediately getting airplay and you're immediately got somebody in your corner helping support you when you come through to tour. So Alberta and Ontario right away are pretty unique. BC doesn't have that same connection at all. They don't have that same kind of cultural heart. It's strange, you know, and that BC is where I'm from. I think people think of BC as being sort of the artsy province in a lot of ways, but it's not compared to Alberta. Alberta's wealthy too, you know. That's you know, that's a very obvious thing, but there's money and it does trickle down into the arts. So, you know, Alberta's got a lot of things going for it.
What strikes me about the conversation we're having is how important it is to think about your career from the point of view of an independent musician. I meet a lot of people who, particularly when they're starting out, their art they know, and they know their creativity, but they have trouble putting together a little bit of the business side that's really important to actually make sure at the end of the day, you can sit there and hopefully, you know, count out what you have managed to make through your music throughout a year and realize that you have something that's sustainable. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, it's incredibly difficult. And without sort of going on and on about it, I mean, everybody's life is difficult. Making a living is a hard thing to do, no doubt. But if you choose to become an entrepreneur, which is sort of what musicians are, you're marketing your own product that you believe in yourself. And not only that, but it is actually you. It's you physically. And it took me a long time to understand when I was signed to True North Records and True North was distributed by Sony, to understand what exactly a record label was doing for me as an artist, but also what they were doing in and of themselves. And they are trying to support their staff, their overheads, everything by selling records. And they have to sell a lot of them to make that happen. And they have to take risks on some that won't sell or might not sell right away, blah, 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 blah. As an artist, an individual artist, you're taking that whole model down to just one, you and the one record. You know, it becomes harder to sell a product of an album because there aren't any more stores to sell them in, and the product itself is becoming less and less. It doesn't have a worth. When I put out Between Hurricanes, Jan, it was wild. I put out Between Hurricanes, and the day I released it, I got an email from a friend of mine who said, I'd like to order a hard copy of Between Hurricanes. And he said, by the way, it's a really great record. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, oh, I've already heard it. And I said, where? He sent me a link right away. And there was a website based out of Czechoslovakia, I don't know where, somewhere in Eastern Europe. And they had the whole thing up, the whole album, all the tracks, all the artwork, everything. You could go get it for free. So it's like all that file sharing stuff, you know, that discussion is over and done with. That genie is out of the bottle. There's no getting it back in the bottle. So the only people that buy records now are the people that understand the connection between the sale of a record and how an artist makes their living. And they want to support that. So they buy them at shows. They buy them as mementos that mean something, that remind them of that show and that performance. They're moved to buy it, and they want to make a connection with you. That's how I sell my records. Selling my records in stores really doesn't even exist for me anymore. I'm like the Fuller Brush salesman traveling around the country with a bunch of stuff in the trunk, and that's how I make my living. And so once you understand that as an artist, then it becomes very clear that you have to engage your audience because they are going to pay for you to continue with the privilege of doing this job. And Tom Wilson and I joke a lot about finding ways to earn money so that we can continue to indulge our hobby of playing music. I mean, it really is like that. You know, I got caught up in my earlier days in the sort of the whole lie of the music industry, which is that, you know, everybody is really rich and famous and successful, and it's utter horseshit. Most people are not making a living at it. A small portion of people are able to make a living at it and therefore able to do it full-time. And a tiny, minute portion of people are making serious money, like big money. And if they are, it's for a very short amount of time. There's a whole lot of artists that existed and got their start in the business when the record labels were still in existence. And the sort of triumvirate of record store, record label, and radio station, this triumvirate, this triangle that was linked together commercially, still existed. That's been broken and is gone. It used to be that your label put out a record, you flew to a town, the local radio station that promoted that kind of music, whether it was Rock 101 or whatever it was, they would promote the show and they would buy tickets and give some away. And just promote the show, just help the show by buying tickets. And in doing so, they were trying to build you up as an artist so that you could sell more records. And then the local record store might have you in to do a signing, and they would put a poster for the show on the window, and the record label would buy advertising in the paper, and everybody was scratching each other's back, and it went around and around and around. When it worked, it generated money because it generated buzz and interest. People came to the show, they bought the record at the store, blah, blah, blah. But it's fallen apart completely because, the record industry doesn't exist anymore. And so you don't have that kind of infrastructure and that kind of support. You have to do it yourself as an artist. And so in a lot of ways, the potential gross that you can make has gotten tiny, but the net that you get to keep has gotten bigger. So if you're canny and you have enough chutzpah to keep at it day and night, you know, working things like this machine that we're talking on right now and my computer, which is right in front of me, you can generate enough money to continue to work and pay your mortgage and pay your expenses.
I remember a line you used a few years ago at a show we were at, and you said that selling CDs at concerts was like food stamps for musicians. And actually, interestingly, that's a line I use all the time. I give you credit every time I use it, but I've used it on the radio, and whenever I MC at a festival and I'm trying to encourage people to go to the merch tent, I always say, well, Stephen Fairing said this in a concert, yep. And it's so important to try and get people to pick the music up. I'm going to ask to take a break in a few seconds because this is a great conversation, but I just wanted to say one other thing. I find my hardest role is to tell people that instead of looking at that tiny percentage of people at the top that are making scads of money at the moment, the best music isn't there at all. The best music is way towards the bottom with those people who are scratching out a living like you're talking about. And that's part of the reason I like to do what I do, because I see my role as more hopefully somebody who could say, look, I heard this, it's really good. This is where I think you need to be focusing, you know, not on the latest music that's being put out by these, you know, multinational record conglomerates.
I guess it all comes down to what it is you want from your music. You know, it's to me, it's no different than beer or wine and there, you know, food. You know, there is good junk food. There is good mass-produced beer, wine, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's often homogenized and brought down to the lowest common denominator because that's how it appeals to the most people. It's, you know, it's like buying clothing. You know, if you can fit medium or average, if that's your size, that's your shoe size, then you're in luck because that's what's going to be out there. If you're like me and you have massive feet, when you go to the shoe store, it's like all these beautiful shoes, but I can only wear that hideous, clunky, ugly pair in the corner because it's the only one that fits on my feet. It really depends on what you want. But, you know, I do believe there's some great mass-produced music out there that I really enjoy. But if I existed on a diet of that alone, I would go mad. It really is not enough. It's like you can't survive on that kind of diet. For me, you got to have a lot of other things, and that means you've got to go hunting for it. I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people, and you know, the one thing that's kind of in some ways done in the music business, record label business, the computer is also at the same time opened doors to people to music that they didn't even know existed. It's relatively easy to go and find stuff on the web that you didn't know existed and make a connection with the artist that created it.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. My guest today is Stephen Fearing. You're listening to Folk Roots Radio. I'm Jan Hall. We're going to take a break with another song from Tea and Confidences. I'd like to play the single, which is We Came Together.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that song?
Sure. That one, I think that one came from a guitar riff as well, which is the da-na-na-na-na. Andy and I, you know, our musically, our background is really based in the UK, England. We both grew up listening to Top of the Pops. The Beatles, you know, all that stuff. And then later Andy kind of really emerged through the punk scene. But when, as a brief digression, if you were a punk, it wasn't cool to listen to the Beatles or Led Zeppelin, but they all did. And I think that Andy's musical background was really based, even though, you know, he grew up in Ireland, so traditional music is a big part of it. In the north of Ireland, traditional music would have been a very political thing. You know, if you listened to certain songs, you were Catholic. If you listened to certain songs, you were Protestant. Listening to the Beatles was not political. Listening to the Sex Pistols and the Clash was not political. It was free of that. And so pop music, be it the Beatles or the Clash, you know, the pop music of the day was politics free. For me, in the south of Ireland, it was just, you know, the radio was dominated by what was coming over from the UK. So I listened to a lot of that. And when we got together to write, that was a big part of where we came from. If you listen to what the Beatles were writing and Led Zeppelin and a lot of that sort of era of music, and punk to a degree too, it was hugely influenced by American music, black music, blues music, roots music. And so it was seen through the lens of the UK artist. You know, the great stories of Keith Richards, you know, rushing to his local store to buy a Howlin' Wolf 78 and realizing that he was probably the only person in the UK that had it, or maybe a handful of five. You know, that kind of exclusivity and passion that they had for that kind of music. And then they digest it and spit it back out, and it becomes the Rolling Stones. And they feed it back to America. And with us, with Fearing in White, is certainly not as dramatic as that, but it is very much a similar process of we were listening to all of those UK bands and ingesting it. And then you go out in the world and you do your thing and you start looking for a way to bring some of those influences out. And Fearing in White is exactly what that is for both of us. It's a way for us to indulge our great love of British pop music in plus other things. And a song like We Came Together is a great mashup of, on the one hand, it's the Everly Brothers. I mean, it's a complete steal from the Everly Brothers, but it's also T-Rex. And T-Rex grew up, you know, Mark Bolan grew up listening to blues. Like, it just goes round and around and around. So, I mean, We Came Together as a real mashup of those things.
You're listening to Folk Roots Radio. I'm Jan Hall. This is Fearing in White, and We Came Together from their great new album, Tea and Confidences.
All right. right time, you and me.
That was Fearing and White with We Came Together, which is the single from the album Tea and Confidences. I'm Jan Hall. This is Folk Roots Radio. And my guest today is Stephen Fearing. He's at home in Halifax. And you know, the great thing about talking to Stephen is we have conversations that start in one place and go a whole bunch of other places at the same time. But we probably need to focus now, because what I would like to do in the last third of today's interview is talk a little bit about the shows. And I do want to actually talk about the third member of Fearing and White. That is Gary Craig, who plays drums and percussion. Obviously, with you, he's works with Bruce, also a big part of Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. Can you talk about what he brings to the party with you?
Gary's an amazing player. We really wanted to work with him on the first record, but he got really sick. And we were lucky enough that Ray Ferrugia came in and played on our first record. But when it came time to make Tea and Confidences, we knew that we wanted to work with him. You know, it's funny, as a songwriter and guitar player, I think a lot of acoustic guitar players are actually frustrated drummers, because there's a percussive element to the acoustic guitar that I don't think people realize what a strong element that is, but it's a very rhythmic instrument. And when I started working with Gary, early on in Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, I realized my poor sense of rhythm, and really working with him gave me an understanding of how I wanted to play. It's that potent, you know. He was an influence on me in realizing how I wanted to play rhythmically as a guitar player. So when it came time to making the album, you know, I've been lucky enough to Gary's played on every album I've made since I've moved to Ontario as a solo artist and with Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. And he's kind of the go-to guy for me. It's really hard to describe the difference between a mediocre drummer and a master drummer. Because you listen to it on the surface and they all go boom, tsh, boom, tsh. You know, they hit the snare and the hi-hats and the kick drum. And I mean, just being able to do that kind of boggles my mind. But the last 20% of good as a drummer is astounding. And Gary is that. He's the first call guy. His sense of time, he can push a song forward so it feels like it has momentum without it speeding up. It feels like it's leaning forward, but it's not speeding up, which is a difficult thing to do. He can play on the front of the beat, on the back of the beat, right on the beat, and do that consistently. So the song sometimes feels like it's leaning backwards, but it doesn't slow down. He has a great sense of textures too. And he's one of the few drummers that I know who always asks for the vocalist and his monitors, because he wants to hear what the song is saying. He wants to hear the song rather than just right, here's the arrangement that I have in my head. I play an opening fill, we play eight bars, and then we go to chorus. And some drummers are like that. They're running on this pattern that's in their head of the song. They're basically, I'm driving the bus, here's where the groove is, you guys play to me. Gary does those things. He very much steers the bus, but he also wants to interact. So at some point in a song, it might feel good to speed up. And then he'll make that happen. He'll let that happen. As opposed to, no, this is where the time is. It's got to be here for the whole song. So he's able to kind of let the clutch out. And at the same time, he can hold things back if it should be held back. And we would discuss those things before we play a song. You know, we would discuss, this one feels like it's speeding up. Do we want it to? Should we start it a little faster? You know, all that stuff. And he's able to fine tune on a level like that that kind of boggles my mind.
You know, I wanted to thank you for sharing that, because that's why I love doing these interviews, because I like to get a little bit more understanding of what is actually going on when we're listening to the album on CD or there at the show and you're actually enjoying the performance. Talking of the performances, you're on tour in Ontario and Alberta. Can you give us a feel for what people can expect if they're coming out to a Fearing and White show this time around?
I think we haven't done any shows in Ontario as a trio. We've done a bunch of shows in Alberta so far, early on in the year, with Kent McRae on drums. Great drummer from Calgary. It's different because if people have seen us in the past, it's a duo. And there's a lot of harmonies. That's still very much, that's what we do. We like to sing together and we like to write songs where the two voices may be singing the same thing, or they might be actually even singing different parts, different lyric. We try and write sometimes where it's a call and response. Sometimes I'm singing a different lyric and a melody over top of what Andy's singing and vice versa. And then sometimes he's just harmonizing with me or I'm harmonizing with him. So there's that sort of interaction vocally. Andy's playing a lot of bass on this album, and so we're doing that live as well. He's introduced a new element to the live show, which is when he's playing the acoustic guitar and I'm playing the electric guitar and you have a drummer, which we do, there's a lack of bass happening, and it can make it sound like it's top and bottom, but there's no warm. So Andy's brought bass pedals with him, which he owns a pair of these set of these things called Taurus pedals, which the Police used a lot in the 80s. It's kind of an 80s sound. It's basically a bass synthesizer, and you find the tone that you want, and you just play them with your feet like organ pedals. And it's really fun to watch him do it, because sometimes he's playing this 12-string, singing a harmony part, and playing bass pedals with his feet. But it puts this bottom-end warmth into two acoustic guitars and drums, or electric acoustic guitar and drums, that when he's not playing the bass is gone and is frankly lacking. So it's a new element for us. But mostly by bringing a drummer into it, we've taken a lot of that. Andy used to play the stomp pedal, which was kind of like a kick drum sound. And occasionally he'd kick a tambourine with his foot. So that element's gone. And it means that the songs have a much greater kind of dynamic range and possibility. You know, if we want to play a song, there's a song on the album called Sanctuary, which when we recorded it, we ended up using two different drummers. There's about four electric guitar parts. And, you know, it's like, well, how on earth are we going to recreate this live and get it to feel heavy, you know, and big? Having a live drummer is the only possible way to do that. So it means that we can really fully realize some of the songs that are on the record and go back to some of the songs on the first record and bring them to a place that we weren't able to before.
It sounds like it's going to be a great show. What does the future hold for Fearing and White, or is that kind of a day-to-day thing?
Honestly, I don't know. We have our plans, but it's, you know, it's what I would like to do with Fearing and White is, as a solo artist, I'll never stop playing as a solo artist, but it becomes harder and harder to get onto the main stage at festivals as a solo artist. It's partly, in, I think, in some ways a backlash to the 80s and 90s, where a lot of festivals relied on singer-songwriters. And you saw a lot of male singer-songwriters on the main stages of festivals. And now there's this great flowering of roots music, trios, duos, bands. And there seems to be more and more of that. I mean, making a living selling records is no longer viable. So live music is the only way to go. So a lot of people are hitting the trail and they're out on the road playing live. And there are this vast array of bands, duos, groups of all stripes playing old time music, playing hybrids of this and that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Being a simple, plain solo singer-songwriter and getting on a main stage is difficult. So I'm kind of hoping and angling Fearing and White as a trio to be able to get into that place, because, you know, it's definitely a way to spend your summer and make a living. And then hopefully throughout the rest of the year, we would start angling more into soft seat theaters. It's a very slow process because those kinds of venues book three years in advance. You know, they're starting to book their seasons for 2017, 2016 now. So how do you get them to book you if they don't even know who you are? And if you go through the town where there is a theater and you play the local club, then they're never going to book you. So it's this sort of slow process of getting into that that particular venue. And that's what I'm hoping we'll do. And Europe, that's a part of the world that we've worked some, but we need to spend more time over there. Not necessarily the UK, but Sweden, Germany, Holland, France. You know, and it's logistically difficult. Renting backline is really hard over there. It's expensive. Three airfares, three hotel rooms, you know, on and on and on. So it's just, you know, we just keep at it. We are talking about beginning the process of writing again, and we will have some time on this tour when we get to Alberta a couple of days. And
this interview wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about the Manza guitar incident that became a big thing. I think it reached the CBC.
Yes, it did.
Certainly there was the Twitter war. I'm going to let you talk about this, because to anyone who's not heard, obviously it's about the loss of your guitar. It's a Linda Manza guitar. Fortunately, it was found. It was on Air Canada flight. But take it away and feel free to rant if you need to, because I can only imagine, you know, losing your work tools, which is basically what your instruments are if you're a musician, is huge.
Yeah, it is. It's a really big deal. And it's the nature of my job. I have to travel. I have to fly. I have to drive. I have to give my guitar into other people's care on a regular basis. And you kind of have to accept that things are going to happen. It's going to get broken. It's going to get lost. The hardest thing is when I don't mind flying into an airport and they say, you know what, some of your luggage didn't make it on the flight. We're going to send it to you tomorrow. It's here. Okay. That's fine. You know, it happens. I don't feel great about it, but it happens. And my days of sort of blowing up at the baggage counter, you know, there's no point. Those guys don't have any control over it. What is hard to accept is when they give you a 1-800 number, and this is what Air Canada does, and this is what happened. I was flying home from the Shrewsbury Festival where I'd played with Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, and I flew from Manchester to Heathrow. Terminal 2, which is the new terminal at Terminal in Heathrow, beautiful facility. It's only a couple of months old in terms of having been opened officially, and they're still ironing out the kinks. So I land in Halifax after a six-hour flight, and all my suitcases come off the plane, but my guitar does not. So, you know, I go to the handler, and the first thing the guy said was, "Oh, yeah, Terminal 2. There have been a lot of problems with Terminal 2. We've had a lot of people not getting their luggage." And I thought, oh, great. Anyway, he gives me the 1-800 number, which anybody who's lost a bag with Air Canada knows. You phone and you get put through to a call center in India. So you're speaking to somebody who may or may not have great English. They don't may or may not even understand what a guitar is. You know, it's God forbid you were trying to explain something like you've lost a paddle for my canoe. You know, that would be pretty difficult. But anyway, you go through the process. But what I've always assumed in the past, Jan, is that they have a computer. They know where it is, but they don't know where it is. As it turns out, and I found this out 48 hours later, by the time this whole thing was well underway, I'll go backwards, but I found out later that they basically have access to the same information that you or I do. If you go to Air Canada's website, there's a tracer. You put in your file number, and it says status hasn't changed or status has changed. And the only reason the status will change on your lost bag is when they scan it because they're putting it on a flight. And that it means it's on its way to you or on its way to another destination, then it's going to be sent to you. But until they scan it, they don't know where it is. So for 48 hours, they didn't know where my guitar was. And that was very unnerving to me. And all I could do was phone Karen in Delhi. And she didn't know where it was either. So I just got, you know, we're very sorry, sir. And thank you for your patience. And we're doing our best. Well, works for a private company who's been hired for Air Canada. They're in India. They have no idea where my guitar is. That's not good enough. By putting a post on Facebook saying, you know what, Air Canada's lost my guitar. And then I started tweeting. And then I realized that if I wanted to be smart about it, I would say, @AirCanada, which is their Twitter handle, has lost my @Manzer Guitars guitar from Terminal 2 in Heathrow. If you feel my pain, please RT, please retweet. And it just took off. Within 48 hours, I had this barrage of Twitter tweets going to @AirCanada. And it was all over Facebook. And when I started to notice that it was having an impact on Air Canada is when @AirCanada started tweeting me back personally. Dear @StephenFearing, we are doing our best. Please be patient. Still no status update. So, but I had their attention. And if you understand a company like Air Canada, when you lose your bag and you're shunted through to the call center in India, that's the dead end. That's their stone wall. That's where they want to corral you as an enraged passenger. But when you start hearing from @AirCanada Twitter, you're dealing with their PR people in Montreal. It's a whole different wing of the company. And it means that you have got their attention and they do not like that press. And they, especially now, they don't want that kind of PR. Twitter scares the hell out of them because it can go viral, as in my case, within 24, 48 hours. And it's bad. It's all over the web. And people who have an axe to grind with Air Canada, which a lot of us do, are going to repost and repost and retweet and retweet. And the next thing I knew is CBC in Halifax were saying, hey, do you want to come on air and talk about this? Absolutely. So by the time I went on air, I had been phoned by Air Canada in India from the call center, now a supervisor calling me back, and Air Canada ground staff in Halifax were calling me, and Air Canada on Twitter were tweeting me. And I said, look, guys, you still don't know where my guitar is. I'm going on CBC right now. And I tweeted my last time from the CBC studios, I'm going on CBC @CBC. So now @CBC is involved and they're retweeting. And then it goes on their website. And then the Toronto Star website picks it up. And then the Winnipeg Free Press website picks it up. And then it goes on 6 o'clock news, 6 o'clock CBC radio news. So people out in, you know, my mom in Nelson, BC is hearing this. My friends on Vancouver Island are hearing it. And it's all Air Canada has lost Stephen Fearing's precious Manzer musician wages Twitter war. Blackie and the Rodeo Kings member takes Air Canada to task, blah, blah, blah. It went on and on. And even after they found my guitar, which I basically walked out of the CBC studios in Halifax, got in my car, and my phone rang. Within 15 minutes, they'd found my guitar. And what it meant, what finding my guitar meant, was that somebody at Air Canada had yelled loudly enough at somebody in Terminal 2 and said, find this thing now. This is out of control. So they went and found it, and they scanned it, and then presto, it was back in the system, and all the computers lit up, and there it was. And they had it to me within, it was hand-delivered to me by an Air Canada employee in their own private vehicle. The next day, and he made damn sure that I opened the case and looked at it and said, this is okay. Everything's okay. He asked me 3 times, is everything okay? I said, it's okay. Then I got calls from even 2 days later, I got a call from the call center in India saying, just want to make sure you got your guitar okay. It's like, well, don't you know? I mean, isn't it in your system? This is crazy. They've really got to figure this out, because I'm really lucky. I can send out a tweet or a Facebook to my followers, my likes, my friends, and they respond to something like this. But if you're Jane Blow, Joe Blow, it's much difficult to get their attention, but you can. And that's the thing that people don't realize. You can, if you are diligent enough and you sit at your computer as I did and just start. Spend your whole day doing it, and you'll get their attention, and they will want you to shut up. And the only way you're going to shut up is by getting your bag back. So they'll make that happen. So it's a real lesson for all of us. Do not take "I don't know" for an answer, and do not go quietly into that dark night. Yell and scream, and you'll get results. And Twitter is an amazing resource for us. Anybody who watched Dave Carroll's United Breaks Guitar YouTube video, same story. They bust his guitar. He had no recourse through the usual channels, you know, writing the letter to the nameless person who has absolutely no power in the company and is just following the guidebook. That's not going to work. So he wrote a song called United Breaks Guitars. If you look at it on YouTube now, this is pre-Twitter and pre-Facebook. I think there are 14 million hits. 14 million people have watched that video. That's bad for United. I think he actually made their shares drop.
So does that mean there will be an Air Canada song created then?
I doubt it. They gave my guitar back. You know, they didn't really do anything else. Like, I didn't get a fruit basket or anything. They delivered my guitar to me. Big deal. They were contracted and paid to do that. It took them 3 days. I reckon they should have given me a couple of flyer points or something, but no, they didn't do anything. Yeah. But, you know, there's no such thing as bad press. And I think even though there was a lot of vitriol aimed their way, there was a lot of Air Canada being talked about as well. So I don't really feel like if they lose it again, or if they break it and they don't make it right, then hell yeah. But they did come through in the end. I had to poke them with a stick, but they did come through in the end.
So if Air Canada are listening, Stephen Fearing would like a fruit basket. That's the low end. Stephen, it is always a pleasure talking to you. Fearing and White will be heading out across Ontario and Alberta this September. We have the Ontario dates on our website at folkrootsradio.com. Check out fearingandwhite.com for all of the information about the band and obviously the Alberta dates as well. We only have one last thing to do, Stephen, and that is to introduce the last song, which I would like you to do. The final song will be To the Great Unknown, which I think is a rather appropriate way to finish this today. So I'm going to hand it over to you.
To the Great Unknown is, in of all the songs on the record, it really is a collaboration from the very first impetus to write the song. I think I had a scrap of melody. I think that's how this song started. And Andy came up with the first line, "Forget about religion and books are not enough." And then the idea of "Say a Prayer," it became something that we talked about, wanting to have a phrase that repeated through the song at that specific point in the melody. And it may have been, you know, I can't remember if there were other phrases that were chucked out, but "Say a Prayer" became the kind of thing. And it really became, we wanted to write a song that was a little more spiritual, a little bit more in that direction. I think at that point we had already written a couple of songs that were just for the sheer hell of it, like "We Came Together." We wanted to write something that had a bit more meat on the bones, and that was, you know, something that if you wanted to sit and listen to the lyric and really kind of put together the imagery, there was a story in there. So that's what To the Great Unknown became about. It's really, you know, as two guys who grew up in Ireland and watched the horror and the unbelievable bigotry of the north of Ireland and the church and the way that those powers were harnessed, you know, the idea of spirituality still being a valid thing, that's what we really wanted to get across in the song.
That's wonderful. Stephen, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you. This is Fearing and White from the great album Tea and Confidences Unto the Great Unknown. Thanks again, Stephen. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, man. Thanks a lot.
I'm John Hall. You're listening to Folk Roots Radio.
Forget about religion and books are not enough.
Say a prayer
for all the little things.
I don't know why
or what tomorrow brings. Like a ship out on the ocean, like a child under the stars.
Say a prayer
to the great unknown.
I don't know how
we ended up alone. I believe we will find our way back home. Every picture painted clear.
Say a prayer.
Time is passing on.
I don't know why
the future takes so long. That's the star we've been following. Sky and time is running down.
Say a prayer
every year that passes by.
I don't know why
every hour that's coming gone. Like a ship out on the ocean, like a child under the stars.